You're listening to The Daily Buzz on KCPW and kcpw.org. This is day 8. My name is John Wildman. I am the editor of festworks.com, and we are on location in Park City, Utah at the 2017 Sundance Film Festival. We're coming to you from historic Main Street, where we will be for the next 2 days interviewing some of the most important voices in the independent film world. Our Daily Buzz studio is right in the center of all the festival action during the day at PC Live and is the home of Chef Dance at night. Joining me this morning are my co-hosts Irene Cho, who's also the producer of this program, and Minji Chang of Collaboration. We will be talking about Kickstarter, as well as CAM and The Blacklist, and then we're going to get to some films, The New Radical and A Ghost Story, as well as talking to Sundance legend Christine Choi. We are back on The Daily Buzz. Again, my name is John Wildman. I am here with Irene Cho. And right now we're going to actually not talk about a film, but talk about how films get made, kind of. We're speaking to some good friends from Kickstarter. And we have Liz Cook here and Elise McCabe. And I get to actually start off this segment by congratulating the two of you, because we've had a promotion and a new hire. Liz, tell us what you do. Yeah. What you do now, your title.
Yeah, my new title is the Director of Documentary Film.
And Elise, you've just joined the team.
I've just joined the team. I've had a kind of baptism by fire here, or no, maybe a baptism by snow at Sundance. So I joined the team 5 weeks ago in early December. Yes, and I'm Kickstarter's Director of Narrative Film.
Narrative Film. So yeah. We have both the heads for narrative and documentary. And I'm excited to talk to you two because... crowdfunding, Kickstarter is not a new thing. We're not inventing the wheel anymore. This is now almost a routine process with many filmmakers as they start the idea of making a film in the first place. And Liz, I'd like you to start off and talk about what that process is now versus what it was, say, a couple years ago.
Yeah, actually, you know, it hasn't changed that much in format in terms of just the basics of how you're running a campaign. But I do think that there's just so much more knowledge on, you know, how to best do this out there. There's just a lot more written about it and people are just more educated going into it. So while the sort of fundamentals of running a campaign on Kickstarter, the basics of the page, the rewards, the, you know, you set a goal, you have a certain timeline to reach that goal or else you don't get any of your funding. All of that stuff has been the same since day one, but people are just much more savvy on how to do that now.
And yeah, and Elise, let's talk about that, you know, how filmmakers are now more savvy and easier to launch into what they have to do on their part rather than just simply ask for money.
It is
a legitimate campaign.
No, absolutely. Yeah, I think probably, you know, Kickstarter started, is 7 years old, almost 8 years old. So there's been a lot of development, filmmakers now understand what works. And really, I guess what they really understand is that it's about preparation and that it is a campaign like any campaign requires, advanced planning. You know, you have a month, say, give or take. I mean, some people set goals that can be fulfilled within a handful of days. But on the whole, you know, they're setting a month and really the smart filmmakers are planning that out day by day. They know what kind of activity they want to undertake each day, something different, so that they can access any and all of the interested parties, people that are going to be, you know, kind of somehow invested in, have the potential to be invested in their film. They are going to identify all of those people and figure out a way to get to them, you know, who are the communities who are interested in their project.
Right. And I have to say, I did a successful Kickstarter campaign.
Congratulations.
For my film.
Yeah, nice. Yes.
And it actually worked out, for my film, The Ladies of the House. And I often described it as being, the host of my own Jerry Lewis telethon, for 30 days. And that's how I looked at it, that I was doing my own show. Can you talk about what you have found recently that makes campaigns more successful? Because it's not new, but you guys are constantly refining the process, making new discoveries. Yeah. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. I mean, kind of to what Elise was saying, I think it's about, you know, getting really, really specific on who the audience is for a project and really having a good sense of where they are online. So, you know, I think a common mistake is often people are, you know, like, my film is a film for everybody. And that might be true, but the reality is that's really not going to help you run a Kickstarter campaign and find specific people that you're emailing and connecting with and sort of building this community around the ideas and the subject of the film. So yeah, I think it's the prep, and in that it's really like, you know, fine tuning who are you reaching out to? Who is the specific audience?
Do you find that as filmmakers that are on the documentary spectrum versus the narrative feature spectrum that they have to ask for different things when they're running their campaign?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really good question. I think actually almost every project, regardless of narrative or doc, is asking kind of for different things. It just sort of depends on what the subject is specifically. The real sort of crux of it is, you know, who are you? What's the story that you're telling? And how are you communicating that to a group of people that are going to be invested in this? And that's kind of true across both. You know, I think documentary can play out kind of differently because sometimes there's sort of an inherent, you know, issue and a community that kind of is already established around that. Whereas maybe some narrative, it's a little bit less clear. But, you know, the crux of it is like, you know, what is your voice? What is the story that you're telling? And how is that going to be made available to other people?
And as curators, I see that as being a big part of your role. Do you see projects where you want to help get them to the finish line, but it's really up to the campaign, and so you just have to be patient and wait and see what happens?
Yes and no. I mean, there are things that Liz and I can do to sort of help a project rise up, you know, so it is more kind of findable. And there are certainly projects that we are, like, you know, really behind. You know, maybe we have a personal relationship with the filmmaker. That said, we can't make a film, you know, a campaign on Kickstarter succeed without the, you know, full engagement of the filmmaker. It's really, it's their job, and we can support them in doing what they're doing, but we can't do the work for them. So yeah, so a bit of both, really, yeah.
Is there, other than the tools that you provide the filmmakers, is there sort of a crash course that, you know, is like a school for kickstarting, so to speak, that, you know, has been effective?
Yeah, well, so we have an incredible team, actually, that's called the education team. They've created a ton of resources. There's a creator handbook that's online that really walks through everything from prep to fulfillment, everything in between. You know, we've done video series, filmmaker video series, where we've interviewed past creators and had them speak to various points of, you know, like, what was it like for you to get press for your campaign? How did you think about doing your rewards and things like that? And then we spend a lot of time on the road, doing that very thing, like the crash course, where we do like workshops with filmmakers. We do, talks about sort of like Kickstarter 101. This is kind of what you need to know when you're putting together a campaign for a film.
I have a crazy question, but can you give us an example of a project you never thought would get funded, but it came through?
What a good question. I'm such an optimist that I'm like, really, I don't really like take a look at something and go, you know, good luck, buddy. I really can try and, you know, rally around pretty much any. I mean, there have been kind of kooky ideas, but nothing that I've been like, you are doomed.
I think I'm probably a bit more of a pessimist, and there have definitely been projects over the last couple of years where it's got to like the day before, you know, projects that I'm vested in and I want to succeed and I believe could succeed, but for some reason are like 15% funded with 48 hours to go, and I'm like, ugh, buddy, you're doomed. And they've made it.
Wow.
And they've made it, because there's something about the all or nothing kind of nature of the site that just means like people pull it out at the last minute, and it's unbelievable. I'm like, how did you raise 30K overnight? I don't know, but
well, that's the thing, and
I'd love to finish on that, which is the idea of those tried and true metrics. Like, you know, I remember when I did, it's like, well, if you reach this level of your goal by this date in the campaign, you're still doing okay. And if you reach, and then the next, and so you're always constantly going, okay, now we have to be at this point. And then, you know, we have to be at this point. And have those, you know, has that changed? Has the goalpost moved at all? Or is it still roughly the same?
You know, it's roughly the same since day one, which is really interesting. It hovers right around 40 to like 42% success rate.
Wow. Wow. Okay. Well, again, we've been talking about Kickstarter with the new champions of Kickstarter, Liz Cook and Lise Cave. Thank you both for being here.
Thanks for having us.
We are back on the Daily Buzz. Again, my name is John Wildman. I am here with our producer and my co-host, Irene Cho. And right now, we're going to be talking to Stephen Gong. And Stephen is with CAM and the Center for Asian American Media. And I rarely read like the boilerplate descriptions, but I want people to understand what this great organization is about. CAM is a nonprofit organization dedicated to presenting stories that convey the richness and diversity of Asian American experiences to the broadest audiences possible. And they do this by funding, producing, distributing, and exhibiting works in film, television, and digital media. It's definitely necessary, and as we know, and it's great to have you here.
Thank you very much, John.
Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning, and good to be here.
Thank you, Irene. Nice to see you in all of the snow right here in Park City. So tell us, why Sundance? Why is CAM here?
Well, you know, Sundance is a nonprofit, just like CAM, and our mission is to kind of work a little bit on the edges, but to really bring many more kinds of important, diverse, and independent voices to our media.
And what kind of themes and presence are you seeing by Asian American artists here this year?
Well, you know, it's by Asian American artists and all communities of color. It's really been exciting and exhilarating to see how diverse Sundance has come. I've been a couple of times. Last time was probably about 9 years ago, and there's a real amazing difference, and you can see it. In a way, it's not a surprise, you know. Our country is in tremendous kind of turmoil right now, no doubt, and the issues of who belongs really is central to the kind of problems that we confront as a nation. And I think a place like Sundance, it's not a surprise, you know, that it since it gathers the kind of most urgent voices in independent media, that it would really, people that want to and need to work in this space are really congregating here, and the Asian American communities are a big part of that.
I noticed that CAM was involved with two major events here in Park City during the festival. Why don't you talk a little about that, starting with the CAM Breakfast and the Utah Film Commission?
Oh, yes, sponsor. Yes. One of our board members and a real wonderful supporter of Sundance, Naja Pham Lockwood, is now on the Utah Film Commission and asked us to come up and talk about the possibilities for more production in Utah by Asian American filmmakers. You know, and at first blush, you might think that that's kind of anomalous, isn't it? This state's about 80-90% Caucasian. But as a matter of fact, there is a real rich history. For instance, one of the 10 Japanese American internment camps was here in Utah. And a number of many of the internees of that experience stayed on in Salt Lake, and there have been several films made about that communities. And then I should also just mention, of course, the Utah community, the Salt Lake community, is really a great refugee center, and there are a number of Southeast Asian refugee communities in Salt Lake. So one of the things I said was, you know, it's all about breaking down stereotypes. Our work. And in our whole country, we are divided so much by stereotypes. So we know that Asian Americans are everywhere, and Asian American stories are everywhere, and that's one of the ways we want to work. So actually, encouraging people to do production in Utah, I think, makes all kinds of sense.
Well, you know, I'm old enough to remember the excitement of a Joy Luck Club. And the discussion in the press and the media, how it was going to open the door and there was going to be so much more production that involved Asian Americans and Asians, and then the disappointment and the stories that followed that did not happen. And of course, it also happens with the African American community as well. But what I love about this group is that and I'd love to have you talk about this, is that, you know, filmmakers don't need a pat on the back. Their parents, their loved ones give them pats on the back. They need concrete help. And an organization like yours actually gives concrete assistance to filmmakers. And I would love for you to talk about that.
Wow, thank you, John. Absolutely. You know, all creative, all people here. I mean, the great thing about the American experiment is the recognition that you can base a society and a culture on the strength of one's character and initiative, right? And not on other kinds of means of recognition. Now, we get this wrong sometimes, but it is frustrating to know that you've got enormous talent in your community, but they don't have the opportunity. Well, several things are happening. An organization like ours comes along, and what we're trying to do is find the ways in. We do a lot of work in the public media space, on public television. That's an important space, but of course, even more important now, and as we move from a broadcast environment into a streaming and on-demand and menu-driven, it's really a remarkable time for talent to arise and for stories to be shared all across the way. So one of the things we're trying to do as an organization is use this 37-year experience that we have in running a film festival and in doing work in public media and independent film, and also try to see how what we can do in this new space with many of these new content providers.
Let's talk about the 13th annual Asian American Filmmakers Experience that was just this weekend that Visual Communications and CAM and Rise Media put together. Can you talk a little bit about the panel and the reception?
Absolutely, Irene, and you were a big part of that, so I did want to acknowledge that too.
Thank you.
Yeah, our colleagues at Visual Communications, which is the oldest Asian American media nonprofit in the country, it's every year we had gathered to celebrate Asian and Asian American creatives, and this year we really loaded it up big. We had an amazing panel. We had Justin Chan, who's here with his film Gook. We had Lisa Nishimura from Netflix, and Effie Brown, and Brooks and Diamond from Black House. So, you know, it was really an amazing kind of rich and mixed dialogue. Grace Lee, Philip Fung, Ann Lai here from Sundance. What we tried to do is the theme was elevate, incubate, and demonstrate. And the whole idea is actually not just to pat one another on the back or to be frustrated. It's what concretely we can do. So having Lisa from Netflix just giving recognition that there are these new entities that are hungry for authentic voices. So the clear thing is that having authentic, unique perspectives in media is really what's going to distinguish new works instead of just relying on set known intellectual properties and things like that. So, you know, I think it's going to be a wonderful sort of future ahead.
So what's next? Moving forward, what can our listeners, what can our audience, what can our supporters do to help organizations like CAM and to represent the Asian Americans and minorities in this space?
One thing, well, we plan on coming back each year and building on this. We also, down in San Francisco, have an 11-day film festival ourselves. It's in March. It's called CAMFest. We would love to see folks there. There are wonderful festivals also, Asian American festivals in Los Angeles, San Diego.
Dallas,
yes. Houston, or Austin, D.C., Pittsburgh. You know, for listeners, there are ways to connect, and we are increasingly moving stuff online. So if we'll see you on the road in another city. If not, next year back here at Sundance.
Fantastic. Well, again, we've been speaking with Stephen Gong from the Center for Asian American Media, or CAM. Stephen, thank you for joining us.
Very welcome. Pleasure.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Daily Buzz. Again, my name is John Wildman here with my producer and co-host, Irene Cho. We're going to talk about the film The New Radical. I'll pause for effect. The New Radical screens in the U.S. documentary competition at Sundance. We're talking with the director, Adam Lowe, and one of the subjects of the film, one of the New Radicals, Cody Wilson. Guys, welcome to the show.
Thanks, man.
All right. Before we dig into this, because there's a lot to dig into, and I'm told I have a limited amount of time to chat with you guys, I'd like to give our director the opportunity to introduce the film to our listeners.
Well, The New Radical is a documentary about a loose-knit group of radical millennials in the United States and the United Kingdom. attacking the system through dangerous technological means. And one of the stars of the film is Cody Wilson, best known for printing the world's first 3D printed gun.
Yes. Okay. Now, Cody is one of the new radicals that we talk to, or that we learn about in the film, and that we follow in the film. But can you talk about? Let's start off. What gave you the inspiration for doing the film in the first place? Like, how did you discover about Cody?
Well, I actually discovered Cody on NPR. I was driving through the streets of Los Angeles, heading to a meeting, and flipping through the channels, landed on this interview, and this guy started talking, and completely blew my mind what he was saying. It was at the same time provocative and enraging, and I didn't know what to think. And I actually had to pull the car over and stop and just listen to the end of the interview. After that, I knew I had to contact this guy and see what he was up to. And I flew down to Texas and did a test shoot with him for a couple days. And we actually really hit it off.
Well, yeah, and Cody's, again, one of three or four guys that you follow and you profile in this film. And one of the things that I love the film because, yes, there's information that you're giving that, you know, some of which I knew, I was really going, I had no idea about. But there's also an excitement about this film, you know, because of Cody and because of these guys, there's this constant idea of threat, you're going to be shut down, that everybody's going to be shut down, everybody's going to be caught, something's going to happen. And can you talk about, as a filmmaker, being in the middle of that? I mean, you're embracing it because you're making the film about this, but now you're becoming part of it as well.
Right. Well, very early on, we knew that this was going to be a serious issue, especially after Cody told me that he was under surveillance. And then during our first interview, the mics started going in and out because the FBI had planted mics in his house. So I had to learn how to do things I had to learn PGP, which took me the better part of a day to figure out how to use this program to encrypt all my communication. We had to take precautions everywhere. You know, we had to ship drives, encrypt them. It was kind of a pain in the butt, but it's the reality of what these guys are living. And as a documentary filmmaker and, you know, journalist as well, I see more and more journalists using PGP and putting their keys on their websites. Something that, you know, we have to reckon with in this day and age. And I don't think it's going to get any better with Pompeo and Trump in office.
Right. You know, and watching it, gives, of course, immediately I'm thinking about Laura Poitras and, you know, and what she had to go through with Citizen Four. And Cody, you know, I also, as I'm watching this, you know, you get the impression, well, this is just all old hat to you. This is what I do. This is what happens. This is how this works. You know, where anybody else would be like shaking in their boots, you know, through this thing. But you're like going, yeah, you know. This is what we do.
Some of that's bluffing. Some of that must be bluffing, I think. there are like cyclical moments of processing dread, right? Like physically processing dread. But I think, yeah, to a degree, you saw this was events captured over the course of 4 years. I am acclimated to some degree to the kind of just everyday dread of it all. I mean, you have to just kind of continue with your life or else you'll go crazy, right? So just
right.
Proceed.
So, Cody, what was your reaction when Adam reached out to you?
Honestly, look, I had been in 13 and 14, I'd been reached out to a lot by many pitched a lot by documentary filmmakers. And actually, it was Adam's work. I Googled Adam's work and I appreciated him as an artist. And I thought, well, regardless of his take, I thought it would be done with some art and some taste, regardless of how much they took the piss out of me. So I decided to go for it. Maybe we'd make some art, you know.
Well, there's also the thing, you know, when you're the subject of a documentary, you know, oftentimes, someone's just, you know, because of some perspective or, you know, some interest factor, they're going, well, we're going to follow you with cameras because we just want to see. But you literally have a mission. And so there's a thing of like, you know, well, you're following me and I want myself to be in a certain light or not, but I also have a message I want to get out. And can you talk about that? Because that's a little bit different as far as being the subject of a film.
In terms of this project, and I guess recent projects, the last couple of years, I just think more and more that men and women can be judged by their actions more than anything else. And so the message was simply, I was grateful that Adam was capturing Amir and I just doing things. showing people, or the people to come, maybe, like, you know, look, this is furious action. We can all be big esoteric, you know, Twitter personalities, but there's a real politics, and there's just the reality of action, and I wanted that to be captured.
You're a very mature millennial, I have to say.
I don't think it speaks highly of me. It speaks poorly of my generation, I think. But thank you. Thank you for saying so.
Okay, and there's also there is a legitimate growth, you know, through the process of the filming of this, and I would love for both of you to talk about that we're not just landing on, you know, on the subject, we're not just landing on the 3D gun, there's a longer thing that kind of transpired during the filming of this and during that, and it kind of steered around, and I think maybe some different ways, I'm guessing, than what you thought when you initially started the project.
Well, for me, it was, I never wanted to make a film that was just purely topical. I like to say every narrative film I make is, I shoot it like a documentary, and every documentary film I make, I shoot it like a narrative. So to me, all great stories show growth and track change in the characters over the course of the film. So it was a very conscious effort in the editing to tease that out and to show how these guys had aged and changed and, you know, maybe become a little bit, what's the word I'm looking for?
Jaded, maybe?
jaded, yeah. A little jaded, a little world-weary over the course of their fights with various world governments and financial superstructures.
When I was introduced to the film by Ted Gagan, who's doing the PR for you, he emailed me and he said, as you watch this, you'll probably punch the wall a couple times and smack yourself in the forehead a half dozen times. And I would love for you to talk about that. You know, it's one thing to follow and these guys and to get this footage and what have you. But when you're in the editing process, and you're striking a balance between that emotional reaction that I have and the storytelling. And can you talk about that?
Well, I mean, storytelling always comes first and foremost, because that's the vessel that everything in the film is put into. I'm a storyteller. I'm not a pure newsman or journalist. I got into this because I love telling stories. So we always track the story first and foremost.
And Cody, I know we don't have much time, but I'd also love for you to chat for just a moment about the fact that, you know, now that this film exists, do you see this as now something that you can, you know, with Adam, use the film as a launching point to then talk about the stuff that you have been really talking about for a while?
I guess we'll see the kind of momentum the film gets. I mean, this isn't our first rodeo. I want it to do well for Adam. I hadn't even seen a cut of the film until like last week. So, I mean, this is all new to me. I think there's something honest about it, and maybe universal, that it's just good for young people to see it, maybe. And I'm not sure that it's necessarily a platform for me to kind of extend beyond the things that I've said in the film, but I could be wrong.
All right. Well, again, the film is The New Radical, and we've been talking to the director, Adam Lowe, and one of the subjects of the film, Cody Wilson. Guys, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you, guys.
You're listening to The Daily Buzz. Again, my name is John Wildman, here with Irene Cho. And right now we're going to talk to somewhat of a Sundance legend, Christine Choi. Christine, welcome.
Thank you. Good morning, Christine. I like to refer to this segment as our Festival Insider segment. Not only are you a Festival Insider, you're a Sundance regular. So tell our audience why you're here at Sundance this year and what your film is.
I have this wacky film cost me absolutely zero money, and it's called Legal Smuggler with Christine Choi. Why? Because I smoke. And I smoke a rather peculiar brand called Benson & Hedges Ultra Light Deluxe. And I have my students, when they leave the country, and they take a picture of the cigarette pack. Please bring me something, you know, because that duty-free is cheaper. They all brought me the wrong brand. Therefore, I had to be very clever. How am I going to get my cigarettes and not piss my money away? So I took a flight to Toronto, and I bought 8 carton cigarettes. But without knowing, after you arrived in Toronto, through the immigration, and I came downstairs, coming next flight back to New York, I had to go through security again. And the big sign says you only allow 1 carton. So here I have to make a decision. Either get rid of 7 carton cigarettes or take a risk. While I was on the line, nervous wreck, imagining what would happen if I get busted. Cigarettes is going to be confiscated. I will be thrown in the jail without cigarettes. And I'm a professor at the New York University. What a lousy example. So then I flashback of why I got addicted to cigarettes. Very simple reason. When I was in the Catholic school, the girl said 3 things you must have to look like a movie star. High heel, stuffed bra, and cigarettes. I never able to really be perfect with a high heel. And I'm already have a flat breast. I don't need fake stuff. And so I took up the cigarettes. That's how it happened. Catholics. And I learned how to drink by looking at the priest and then the nuns, because it's blood, you know. My addiction is from very pure Anglo-Saxon culture. I am Asian American, half Korean, half Chinese, okay? So you know, the story is quite unique because we've been looked upon as model minority. We don't drink, we don't smoke, we don't hitchhike, you know. I'm complete opposite.
So, Christine, you're also a very well-revered and respected filmmaker. Let's talk about your history with Sundance. How long have you been coming to this festival?
First, Irene, I need a really honorary Oscar. You don't know I'm the first Asian-American filmmaker in this country, period. I started making film when I was 17, and that was long time ago. Oh, I made a film called Who Killed Vincent Chin?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And it was a murder case, took place in Detroit in 1983, and the 2 killers got off scot-free. And when I saw this case, seems like it was nobody really reported authority. Because these 2 killers didn't have a previous criminal record, they got 3 years probation and $3,000 fine by killing an Asian. The reason they killed him because they thought he was a Japanese. We all look like, don't we? At that time, the union did not address the issue of outsourcing. And they said that because Japanese car was much more fuel efficient and replaced the American made car, so therefore you are lost your job. So there was a lot of racism towards Asians. So I went to Detroit. Lord, I didn't know the case went on for 5 years. 5 years. I was a teenager. Then by the time I finished the movie, I was like middle-aged. But the film was invited to Sundance, which I was, at that time, it was not even called Sundance, called U.S. Film.
Mm-hmm. Video festival.
Right.
It was a very, very small festival. And about 15 or 20 filmmakers. And I happened to stay in the same lodge with Steven Soderbergh. He brought the Sex, Lies, and Video. However, the entire jury were all white. All the participants, all white. Everybody's white. Coordinated white, you know. So one day I think we were having a coffee with Robert Redford. I said, Robert, don't you think it's rather weird? It's white people on white snow. I can, if there's a black person skiing down, I can just see a black dot coming down. So he said, you're right. And his right-hand person's name is Tony Saffer. And he grew up, I think, in New York or Los Angeles. I think he had a better sense. You know, there is diversity in America.
Yes.
So they asked me to be a jury member the following year. That's when I started come to Sundance. And then later on, I was jury member again. Then I became the chair of the graduate film at Tisch School of the Arts. Being a chair, there's obligation you have to come to Sundance every year to support your students. So I was in and out for about 6 years. finally, I decided I don't want to be chair anymore. I want to be a table. So I never really bothered the thinking coming to it. Sundance. Right. And my little crazy film, Legal Smuggler, with the Christine Choi, got in New York Film Festival and got in Sundance. And it was done, conceived by me, performed by me, written by me, directed by Louis Kloster, edited by Louis' younger brother, who was only 17 years old, okay? Never saw me, never met me, and he animated. In fact, in retrospect, it was really original. And it was in the short program and number four program. And I looked at through all the films they program and has this subtle thematic connection is how do you take a risk? Whether in personal life, or whether you're diving into the pool, whether getting cheap cigarettes, or Nigerian girls got arrested and jumping off the truck from the, you know, the kidnappers, or a couple who live together 45 years, do not like each other, but still taking the risk, try to maintain the relationship. And furthermore, an African-American activist from the civil rights movement, right-hand person of Martin Luther King, black, adopts his lover as a son who is white. So you're looking at, and also the musicians taking risks against the white supremacies in London, you know. So the risks are very varied. There are political risks, there are social risks, personal risks, you know. Mm-hmm. And making a decision whether you're going to take the risk is not an easy decision. As a filmmaker, as a creative artist, you have to take a risk.
So where do you get that drive from? Where is that? What motivates you, Christine? You're a force to be reckoned with. You are fierce.
My life experience. My life experience, I was born People's Republic of China, which is communism. Then we were asked to leave before the Cultural Revolution to Hong Kong. At the time, Hong Kong's colonialism under British. Then we moved to South Korea, Seoul. And South Korea had 45 U.S. troops stationed in the middle of like a Fifth Avenue and basically was a neo-colonized country. Then I moved to Japan, in which is, you know, monarchy, all right? I arrived in the United States at the age of 14, and it's advanced capitalism. So the ism is, I never really believe you should have a completely set mind of an ideology or thinking. I mean, words is changing, people are changing, and being an artist, you had to be much more flexible at taking small risk at certain time.
Well, everybody, you've been listening to The Christine Choi Show. We usually call this The Daily Buzz, but right now it's The Christine Choi Show.
And you know, Christine Choi is not my real name.
What's your real name?
Yeah.
My real name in Chinese is Choi Ming Hui. In Korean, it's Choi Myung He. But nobody in American can pronounce Choi. Can you do it?
Choi?
Ming.
Ming.
Hui.
Hui.
Excellent.
He's honorary Chinese.
And when I was Catholic school, the nun said, you look so innocent. You know, there is a saint named Teresa, so they renamed me Teresa Tsai.
Yes, sir. Honestly, I think we could just postpone the rest of our filmmakers and just listen to you all day.
I agree.
But
send
Christine, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you.
It's a real honor. Thank
you. And her last name is Cho. Chisha?
Cho Xiao.
Cho.
Cho.
Thank you.
Bye.
Welcome back to The Daily Buzz. My name is John Wildman here with the co-host and producer, Irene Cho. And right now we're going to talk to Liz Cardenas Frankie. Liz is in the film A Ghost Story. And I wanted Liz to come on the show because, one, she's a very good friend of mine. And this is a very exciting time because this is her first Sundance. And while A Ghost Story is a big story, A Ghost Story is a story of this festival. We can't really talk about it. I don't know a lot because they're not really a big press thing that they want to be done. But I really want to talk about Sundance and what it's like to come to Sundance for the very first time and what that experience has been like for you.
Oh, it's been incredible. Thank you so much, John, for having me on. I really appreciate it. And, you know, obviously I've had lots of friends that are like fellow filmmakers who've been attending Sundance for years. I guess I always wanted to come with a film as opposed to just coming because it is such an exciting, kind of overwhelming experience. And so to be able to come with a film like A Ghost Story has been amazing. I can tell you a little bit, you know, like behind the scenes stuff with A Ghost Story. I'm friends with the writer-director, David Lowry. His wife, Augustine Frizzell, is a very dear friend of mine, and we are both actress-filmmakers and collaborate and work on each other's projects.
And you and Augustine had a film that had a very robust festival run last year.
Yes.
You're no stranger to festivals.
No.
You know, you
but I am a stranger to Sundance.
To Sundance.
So it's been an incredible experience to be here with such a film that I'm so proud of, that is doing so well, and then being able to celebrate with, again, friends that are filmmakers. It's not just, hey, I'm a producer on this film or I'm acting in this film, which is the case. They're also friends. You know, all of us got together to make this movie. And so to be here in my first festival experience with David and Augustine, they've kind of taken me under their wing, as have Toby Hal Brooks and James Johnston, who are producers of A Ghost Story. It's been incredible.
Okay, so let's talk about first. The word comes down. One of you gets the phone call. You're in. What's that moment like? How did you find out?
I found out from them, and I was ecstatic, of course. But I'll be honest with you, I wasn't that surprised. Like, the film is really good.
Okay, jaded. All right, sure.
You know? No, it's not. Look, it's not my film. Like my mind would be completely blown if it was something that I wrote or directed. But you know, David Lowry, both his reputation, the caliber of a filmmaker he is, and then the actual film it is, I really wasn't surprised. Now, as any good artist, you know, you have a reservation, so he's extremely modest. He does not have an egotistical bone in his body, but I personally, as somebody on the sidelines, was not really surprised, but I was so excited and so thrilled.
You know the phrase "a prince of a guy" really does apply to David Lowry. He is that guy. But I should also say, you were not just in the cast; you were also a co-producer.
Correct.
On the film, so you're both behind the camera and in front of the camera on this particular film. Okay, so you get the word; it's all exciting. You're going to Sundance. All right, now you have the premiere coming up. You're actually here at Park City, and you're premiering at the Sundance Film Festival.
I know.
Talk about that experience from your perspective.
It was nerve-wracking. I didn't know what to expect. You know, you're not the lead in the film. I'm not the lead producer, but I'm definitely part of it.
Yeah.
And so to go through, like, the you know, and I've done, like, red carpets. I've done interviews and press for films of mine and others at film festivals, but not Sundance. And so it was nerve-wracking, you know, having your picture taken. You know that these pictures will be seen. Like in other times in other film festivals, you know, you're getting your picture taken, but where's it really going to show up? On this, you know, with a David Lowry, with a Rooney Mara, you know your picture's going to get seen. And so to go through the little line where you're getting your pictures taken and then getting interviewed, it was a little nerve-wracking. And then you've got the elements of Park City. You know, you're trying to look good, but there's like snow and wind everywhere, and then you're trying to look cute in your outfits as an actress, but you've got your snow boots and your, you know, hat and your scarf, and so it's a bit of a balancing act. Whereas most like filmmakers that are just producers, they're not into the look as much, but when you're kind of balancing the whole producer like filmmaker with the actress, you know, you're trying to do both, and I'm probably sounding crazy right now.
No. Okay, now as I mentioned, also, you know, A24, which picked up the film, did not want the film to actively pursue press, and so I'm curious, you know, did a word come down to the production, like, you know, listen, don't, you know, we don't want you doing this, we don't want you doing that, you know, we'll do some photos or whatever, but that's it. Otherwise, you know, it's a no press zone. Does that happen, or is it just more, we'll just take it as it comes along?
Well, it's interesting because, you know, James and Toby and Adam Donaghy is also a producer as well. But James and Toby with Sailor Bear with David Lowery, they're all such good friends, and they're also just laid back guys. And we made this film under the radar in between David's big studio films. We did it a small budget film. It's like, we're all friends. We're like, let's help David with his artistic vision, because he's definitely got one. And we just want to help him make the best movie possible. So because it already had that feel going into the film, in the production, in the post, it was one of those things that they were keeping me in the loop. But I knew that they were trying to keep things kind of quiet, but that's also their way of operating, you know, like they're just real laid back, don't want a lot of, you know.
Well, you bring something up interesting, because of course I live in Dallas.
Yes.
You live in Dallas.
Yes.
And I knew the film was being made.
Yes.
In fact, it was, David was actually, I think it was in between being at the Dallas Film Festival, which he did a panel for us at the Dallas Film Festival, and then introducing a screening at the Oak Cliff Film Festival.
Right.
It was kind of, he was, you know, very much under the radar, but I was aware of the production because I'm friends with everybody.
Of course.
Just like you. But you know, you have movie stars coming to town.
Yes.
And, you know, you have a Casey Affleck coming to
yes.
town. You have a Rooney Mara coming to town. You know, and yet this is not a big announced production.
No.
Talk about that a little bit.
It was an incredible experience. The both Casey Affleck and Rooney Mara were amazing. But it was challenging in terms of being kind of a producer on the film, and that's kind of part of what I was handling, was keeping everything, you know, like under the radar, kind of low key, but then making sure that as these A-list talent were comfortable, taken care of, they were both amazing to work with. Obviously, they're incredibly talented. Obviously, congratulations to Casey Affleck on his Oscar nomination that was announced today. But they were great to work with, both like very cool, very laid back, awesome, and then also, you know, super talented. And I just remember telling them, I think this is so cool that you're coming to do this. And they're obviously, you know, very close with David. And
right,
he's such a talented filmmaker that doesn't surprise me.
Well, again, we've been talking about the film A Ghost Story and the Sundance Experience.
Yes.
With Liz Cardenas Frankie. She's a co-producer on the film and is also in the film. Thank you for
As
being
an actress,
on the show.
Yes. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
We are back on The Daily Buzz. Again, my name is John Wildman, here with Irene Cho. And right now we're going to do one of our Festival Insider pieces, and we're going to be talking with Franklin Leonard of The Blacklist. And Franklin, I never assumed that my audience knows anything about everything or everything
yeah.
about anything. So briefly, let's talk about what The Blacklist is.
Yeah, very quickly. It started, and thank you for having me. It started as an annual survey of the film industry's most liked unproduced screenplays that ended up being quite a predictor of future success of those projects, and we've since expanded into a number of things. We have a website that allows writers from all over the world to upload their scripts, have them evaluated, and if they're good, we tell the entire industry, which has resulted in hundreds of writers signing with major agencies and management companies or selling their scripts. We do live stage script readings. We have a podcast called The Blacklist Table Reads that was one of iTunes' best podcasts of 2015, and here at the festival this year, we partnered with the Autograph Collection of Hotels for a space at the Hotel Park City that was a retreat from the maelstrom of the festival for screenwriters and festival attendees. And most specifically, several of the producers who have films here this year and have had many films here over the course of the last 20 years.
Wow.
Sorry, I ran through that really quick.
No, that's impressive. It's like a boilerplate.
So,
why is The Blacklist important? If you can talk a little bit about how the traditional studio structure works so that people understand.
Well, I think the Blacklist is important. Our goal is to identify and celebrate great screenwriting and the people who do it. And I think that traditionally the system of identifying great screenplays is pretty inefficient in the industry writ large. And so what we do is try to gather together information about scripts that people love, devoid of the economic concerns about making them and making them for profit. And it turns out that when you do that and you make great screenplays, you make great movies, which end up being very successful both critically and commercially, and you end up making a lot of money.
So what are you seeing in terms of why is it so hard for screenwriters to get recognized?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's I think it's difficult for screenwriters to get recognized because they're not the people that are walking the red carpet and they're not the people that are giving interviews. You know, I think actors and directors throughout the history of Hollywood have always been the sort of most celebrated parts of the process. And I think screenwriters are terribly undervalued. They're the ones who first conceive of the story. They're the ones who see the movie first in their head. And without them, you know, directors have nothing to shoot. Actors have nothing to say. Production designers have nothing to design. And so I can't emphasize enough that screenwriters are an invaluable part of a collaborative process, but they're one that historically has been sorely undervalued, and we aim to change some of that.
You know, oftentimes I think writing for independent film is not really put on the front burner because, you know, we're dealing with the smaller budgets. Oftentimes, you know, improvisation seems to be something that takes place. But the truth is that, as with any film, writing is paramount for great success. And can you talk about that, you know, on the smaller budgeted, on the independent level, you know, how important really good screenwriting is?
Yeah, I mean, look, I think good screenwriting is possibly the most important thing. You know, I think it's very, let me put it this way, it is virtually impossible to make a good movie with a bad script. It is certainly possible to make a bad movie with a good script, but you're not going to be able to make a good script without a good movie without a good script. And so, you know, it's a necessary but not exclusive element of, I think, any good movie that any of us have ever seen.
Can you talk about your process? What is the, you know, from A to B, how do you start, and who helps along the way?
So the annual survey is just that. It's a survey. We're emailing at the end of every year roughly 600 executives at the major studios, the production companies who have deals with them, and then other production companies that have made films that have been widely distributed in recent years, and asking them about their 10 favorite scripts that haven't yet been produced and won't be in production by the end of that calendar year. You know, then we count up the votes, put it into an elegantly designed spreadsheet, a PDF document, and put it on our website, blacklist.com. And then the website is a little bit more complicated, but it's for functions in the same way. Anyone on earth can upload their screenplay, pay a small fee, pay to have it evaluated. And if it's good, we then tell the entire industry, this is a really good script. You should pay attention to it. And then we step aside. You know, I like to joke that we're like a dating service for people who write movies and people who make movies. And just like a dating service isn't going to show up on your wedding night and ask for 10%, neither are we.
So who's your team? Do you have a team of writers that do coverage, and how does that change?
So I have a team. I have a partner, Dina Simone, who runs technology and is my co-founder on the website. We have a team of four people, Terry Wong, Kate Hagen, Megan Halpern, and Olga Vasileva, who help me run the company. And then we have a team of freelance readers, all of whom have worked for at least a year as at least assistants at a major agency. And then they're further evaluated by us based on how well they can provide intelligent, well-written evaluations of screenplays that do, you know, the 60,000 script evaluations we've done in the 4 years since we launched.
Can you talk about a couple of the projects that probably would not have been made if it weren't for Blacklist?
Yeah, it's really hard for me to say that something wouldn't be made without the Blacklist. And I tend not to attribute causation to the Blacklist of things getting made. What I can do is quote people who have said other things about it getting made. So Chris Terrio, who wrote Argo, has said that Argo wouldn't have gotten made had it not been for the Blacklist. He said that Ben Affleck found out about it via the Blacklist. Kelly Marcel has said that that her movie would not have gotten made had it not been for the Blacklist. You know, Benedict Cumberbatch said in his interview with the 92nd Street Y that the reason he read Imitation Game when it was sent to him was that it was number one on the Blacklist. So again, I think I've always said that the role of the Blacklist in any individual movie is fundamentally unknowable, but in aggregate, the influence and role of the Blacklist in Hollywood is undeniable.
Are you seeing a lot of minority screenwriters?
Not as much as I'd like. I think that on the annual survey, you know, we're really a reflection of what the industry is reading. And as we know that, you know, Hollywood, like America, has a history of sexism and racism that is endemic to the system. And so, a disproportionate number of the scripts that we're seeing are overwhelmingly by white men, young white men in particular. But I think that's changing. You know, I think for the first time in the last 2 years, we've seen a number of women very highly rated on the list. And a little bit more diversity. On this year's list, a young writer named Evan Dodson, an African-American who is 21 years old and a junior at USC, I believe is the youngest ever writer on the annual Blacklist. So I think we're seeing, there's some shoots and leaves. There's some sort of shoots of change coming, as we also saw with this year's Oscar nominations. But we're far from anything, we're far from anything close to a representative reality when it comes to Hollywood or the Blacklist as a reflection of it.
Let's just briefly talk about what you thought about the Oscar nomination.
Yeah. I mean, I'm very excited. It's one of those years where I know personally a lot of the Oscar nominees, so it's incredibly exciting. For The Blacklist, it was another banner year. Three Best Picture nominees, three screenplay nominations, total of 21 nominations across four films: Manchester by the Sea, Hell or High Water, Jackie, and Arrival. So, I mean, I think it's an exceptional year. I think it was an exceptional year for film in many ways, and I couldn't be happier for the many widely varying talented people who were nominated this year.
In closing, yeah, what kind of advice do you give to aspiring filmmakers and screenwriters?
I think the best advice I can give is to, one, make whatever you're trying to make. If you're trying to write a screenplay, write a screenplay. If you're trying to make a movie, write a movie. There is nothing more... There's no greater obstacle oftentimes to success than oneself. And the second thing I would say is aim high. No one wants to see the 100th retread of the worst movie that made money last year. Try to write something that will leave people leaving the theater looking at the world a little bit differently than they did when they went in. And that doesn't mean it can't be a horror movie or a comedy, but aim to elicit an emotional reaction and recontextualize a person's life for having seen it.
All right. Well, again, we've been talking with Franklin Leonard from The Blacklist. And Franklin, thank you for being on the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And we're wrapping up day 8 of the Daily Buzz on KCPW and KCPW.org. This show is made possible with the support of KCPW and our sponsors, Rice Media and Skull Candy. Additional support is provided by Chef Dance, Cloud Electronics, Enki New York, Angry Porcupine, Pop Art Snacks, Park City Roasters, The Big O Donuts, and The Market in Park City. Our producer is Irene Cho.